Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is December the 25th, 2019. A Merry Christmas and season's greetings to all. A shout out to all the military men and women serving our country and is away from home at this time of the year. We thank you for your services. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program and previous programs are available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. Many listeners have contacted me to let me know that there had been a problem trying to download podcasts of prior programs. We apologize for this, and it's being fixed. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. With everything from cars to trucks to even airplanes going electric, the demand for batteries is going to continue to skyrocket in the coming years. But the availability of materials currently used to make them is limited. So scientists at IBM Research have developed a new battery whose unique ingredients can be extracted from seawater instead of mining. If we're going to avoid the worst consequences of climate change, we need an energy revolution. The problems with the design of current battery technologies like lithium-ion are well known. We just tend to turn a blind eye when it means our smartphones can run for a full day without a charge. In addition to lithium, they require heavy metals like cobalt, manganese, and nickel, which comes from giant mines that present hazards to the environment and often to those doing the actual mining. These metals are also a finite resource, and as more and more devices and vehicles switch to battery power, their availability is going to decrease at a staggering pace. As a potential solution, at IBM's researchers' battery lab came up with a new design that replaces the need for cobalt and nickel in the cathode and also uses a new liquid electrolyte with a high flash point. That's the material in a battery that helps ions move from one end to the other. The combination of the new cathode and electrolyte materials was also found to limit the creation of lithium dendrites, which are spiky structures that often develop in lithium-ion batteries that can lead to short circuits. So not only would this new battery have less of an impact on the environment to manufacture, it will also be considerably safer to use with a drastically reduced risk of fire or explosions. But the benefits of IBM Research's design doesn't stop there. The researchers believe the new battery would have a larger capacity than existing lithium-ion batteries, could potentially charge to about 80% of its full capacity in just 5 minutes, would be more energy efficient, and on top of it all, would be cheaper to manufacture, which in turn means they could help reduce the cost of gadgets and electric vehicles. These results are estimations based on how the battery has performed in the lab so far, but IBM Research is teaming up with companies like Mercedes-Benz Research and Development to further develop this technology. So it'll be quite a few years before you'll be able to feel a little less guilty about your smartphone addiction. There's hope beyond lithium-ion.
I'm Mark Leosa with On the Mark. Recent on-the-mark reviews of hard disk drives and solid-state drives covered the bottom line. For speed, solid-state drives. For price, hard disk drives. There are exceptions. One is your computer. If you're using a USB 2, with newer computers and USB 3, you'll get closer to the published drive specs. You might be wondering what's best for your storage. A quick refresher, a hard disk drive, HDD, has moving parts, the spinning platter and the drive head that reads and writes the data. This uses energy, takes time, and generates heat. There are hybrid drives called solid-state hard drives, or SSHD. The operating system is solid-state, the storage is on a hard drive. A possible solution if you're short on slots for additional drives. Getting back to hard disk drive speeds, it's dependent on the RPM, the revolutions per minute, the drive is capable of. The higher the RPM, the faster the drive can perform. Many budget hard drives have 5,400 RPM, which is the slowest speed modern hard drives are capable of. You're better off going for a drive that can achieve 7,200 RPMs, which is what most modern HDDs have. Here's an example. HDDs using SATA 3, that's Serial Advanced Technology, Attachment 3, connecting to your external drive will transfer about 100 megabytes per second. A hard disk drive with 7,200 RPM will be close to 150 megabytes per second. As the name suggests, an SSD, unlike a traditional hard drive, has no moving parts. Instead, it uses NAND flash memory. The more NAND memory chips an SSD has, the more storage capacity, especially compressing the space going from single-level cell to multi-level cell to triple-level cell being the least expensive to manufacture, holding 3 bits per cell. And you'll probably find it in many of your SSD drives. SSD drives come with SATA 3 ports, which means they can easily be installed in place of an HDD, and many also come with the 2.5-inch format. The maximum data transfer with SATA 3 is 600 megabytes per second. SSDs are capable of much faster speeds, which means if you have an SSD with a SATA 3 and a USB 3 port, it will be approximately 4 times faster than a hard disk drive. The solid-state drive's performance can also be slowed by the maximum flow-through of a USB 2.0. There is a relatively new non-volatile memory express, or NVMe, M.2. SSD drive is like methamphetamine for your computer. For comparison, a hard disk drive running at 7200 RPM will transfer 160 megabytes per second. A solid-state drive with a SATA 3, 600 megabytes per second. The NVMe M.2, 3,500 megabytes per second, almost 6 times faster as the SSD. The reason for the speed is connecting directly to the motherboard on a desktop or using an external adapter on a laptop. There are several DIY kits available for your NVMe M.2 that include a high-quality cable to zip your data along. The NVMe M.2 is not for every computer. Older computers might not be able to accommodate the drive. Also, being relatively new, the prices are high. Some SSDs are more expensive and faster because they use the new M.2. Older SATA 3 SSDs might be less expensive. If lowest cost storage capacity is your priority, hard disk drives are best. If you're looking for fast loading apps and backing up your computer's operating system, and you have a computer with a USB 3.0, a solid state drive might be best. Research the drives that you're interested in, read the reviews and specs of the drives, and see if they're compatible with your computer. You can purchase large storage capacity HDDs for very low prices, but if you're keeping important data on the drives, it's best to check out user reviews and reports about their reliability. And 2 terabyte hard disk drives are dropping in price, and consider using several smaller storage drives, just in case one is damaged or lost. You haven't lost all your data. That's an On The Mark update. Hi, I'm Mark Leos with On The Mark Technology Reviews. 2019 was a year of shrinking storage and greater battery capacity. I see that trend continuing in 2020 and look forward to giving ear to more technology reviews for the Personal Computer Show. Be well.
Marty Winston, the modern-day Christopher Marley.
I'm not the ghost of Christmas yet to come. He has the night off. Hi, I'm Marty Winston, filling in with a few ideas about how Christmas in the future might be able to use a little more tech to make you less of a wreck from doing your prep. I mean, really, there's a lot of work that goes into getting ready for Christmas, and there will be more work getting it all put away again. So sit back with your favorite nog or grog as I share my ideas. Is anybody out there wearing a leg cast or an arm cast right now? Did you need it after falling off a ladder while trying to hang your Christmas lighting? That's the obvious one for me. I'd rather be able to get permanently installed, programmable, color agile LEDs. Let any colors you want twinkle at Yuletide, or stick with the traditionals. Light up the team colors during major sports events, red, white, and blue for patriotic holidays, throbbing red for Valentine's Day, green for St. Patrick's Day, violet and yellows for Easter, or a throbbing red and white that your alarm system can trigger if there's an emergency. You can even light them in white, soft to bright, every night if you want. Install them once, and don't worry about them again for a decade or more. And every time you're ready to light them up, that's one more accident waiting to not happen. So look for LED lighting that is programmable decor lighting for the house. One company making it, or at least I saw a demo of it, is OELO, OELO. Check them out. They may not be the only ones there. Now, do you get a tree every year from a tree farm? That's a bold choice, given the needles that fall off and the need to keep it hydrated and the fire risks and then the challenge of getting rid of it afterwards. Natural-looking LED pre-lighted trees are very appealing to a lot of people, and the simpler it is to transition from spread out in the room to tucked away in the box, the better. Now, about that box, where do you keep yours? I'm liking some of the small ceiling-mounted motorized lifters, like hoists, but with friendlier cradles to hold things. And it holds them up and out of the way if your garage is tall enough. Now, about the gift wrap. Everyone I know, and I mean just about everybody, already vows that this year they're going to unwrap gifts carefully to make the paper easier to recycle. Unwrap carefully. Those are code words for no kids in the house. Two things I'll share about the paper. First, if it's just paper, it's one kind of recyclable, and that's good, and that should say so. But paper with embedded plastics, or foils, or plastics that look like paper, or hybrids with more metal foils in them, may not be recyclable. The recycling center may regard those as contaminated. Keep an eye out for that, and please keep in mind when you wrap the gifts you're sending to others, whether or not the wrap you bought to wrap those gifts in is itself a recyclable wrap. You know, it doesn't say Merry Christmas recyclable in big print, but it should say so somewhere along an edge or something. Now let's talk leftovers, and I mean the food. This is a discussion I want to take in new directions. Some families play it like a frat house and just let everybody free feed on what's left until it's gone. But even with great food, binge eating is never a great choice. Some very organized people become home-based frozen dinner factories, doling out portion-sized helpings into freezable containers. I have a plan that surrenders to what's practical. Not quite buffet, which itself is okay, but more like a sandwich tray. Christmas Eve and Christmas meals may have dinner rolls, but they tend not to be bread-intensive meals, and that's too bad. Slices of ham or turkey or whatever are foundations of some pretty great sandwiches. So be prepared with all of the things it takes to make spectacular sandwiches happen. Pickles and other kinds of condiments and spices and spreads and cheese slices and all that stuff. Veggies, you know, slices of tomato. If there's stuffing, that isn't for sandwiches, but it's pretty awesome. You bet you haven't done this, to fry the stuffing up in a pan and serve it with eggs for breakfast. Potatoes or yams can be good for that, too. And if you're dodging the carbs, cut up the leftover meats and some condiments and use them in a big salad. And for what the English call afters, a light sprinkle of sugar on the cranberry sauce makes it a suitable and very interesting topping for a small scoop of ice cream or sherbet or frozen yogurt, optionally but readily accompanied by a Christmas cookie. Remember, with less to reheat or freeze, you'll also use less energy. A little gift to yourself. And here's an idea about the outdoor decor. Take it down a little at a time. Give the things you take down a chance to drip dry, then put them into a right-sized trash bag for the plastic, not to throw away. Use a piece of masking tape and a marker to label what's in the bag. Use a loop of rope or wire. You know how to do this in a way where you push one end of the loop through the loop and the other end you tug and the loop cinches the bag. Well, its own weight should keep that tight if you hang the bag from a nail or hook overhead. So there's a loop on the nail, there's a loop around the throat of the bag, and the weight of the bag keeps that bottom loop shut. And as to where, hey, got any space in your attic? Now, listen, this is important. This is where you need to be a little organized. Try to put the things away first at the far end that you don't need to get out next year until last, after everything else is out. Indoor decor tends to be smaller. Smaller than outdoor, but more numerous, lots of little pieces, and I don't dare make any suggestions there. Storing that stuff always becomes one person's ritual within the household, and assistance, well, assistance gets interpreted as unwanted interference. As a Beatle said, let it be. If you're not that well-focused an organizer, there's something useful you still can do, something that you've been promising yourself you do each day, so it wouldn't grow into a major after-Christmas task. But did you? I'm talking about double-checking your Christmas card list with the return addresses on this year's cards and making updates or entering the addresses of people you didn't have on your list. And no, I'm not talking about the insurance or real estate or mortuary or car dealer guys who sent those pre-printed cards. I'm not saying that you should plan on printing your labels next year, although there are some nice fonts and interesting templates that could make it look like you hand-addressed the envelopes directly. No sticky on stuff. Only, this time, it might be more legible. Now, a word about the holiday gifts that use batteries. Lots of people buy an extra set of batteries, and they, at least the batteries that those gifts use, the toys especially, so there's a replacement on hand. But lots of kids burn through as many, and I got this from a battery manufacturer, as many as 3 to 4 sets in the first day or two. Having the additional batteries on hand is a good thing, but you don't necessarily want the kids to get so much into that first day play that they can't break away. Think about previous years. The toys get played with like a frenzy on steroids for a day or so, then put away, and that's where I want to focus your attention. Toys that get put away with batteries inside may stay put away for a very long time. And if the toy was heavily played before it was put away, it could already have mostly depleted batteries. Batteries that are stored a long time often leak. Depleted batteries often leak. You could have both. So this weekend, or at the latest next weekend, have the kids drag out their new toys and let you put away or throw away their batteries. Little battery testers don't cost very much and are a great way to decide which to do, put away or throw away, one battery at a time. You know what? I need a break. Who brought eggnog?
Bah humbug. In the Internet of Things, it is the interoperability of devices to communicate with each other.
Are there standards? The answer is there are standards and there are standards. Apple, Amazon, Google, Samsung, and Zigbee, and a host of others have joined up to create a new smart home standard that would be open sourced and based on IP. IP as in Internet Protocol Address, not intellectual property. The idea behind the standard is to make it easier to get new smart home devices on board onto your network and to minimize the need for consumers to have to check to see what is or isn't compatible with their smart home control system, whether that be Alexa, Apple, HomeKit, or Google Assistant. Think of it this way. The smart home has a plumbing problem. Imagine none of the companies making faucets or even pipes were willing to talk to each other, so every single connector was different depending on the company. And none of them even agree on how to route hot, cold, and sewage water. And just to fix a sink, you have to commit to working with a single company, to work with a single company in perpetuity, and too many competing smart home standards. So what do we have today with smart devices and how they interoperate with each other? It is to make a new one to unify them. And of course, that new one would not actually do that. And then there will be yet more standards. Would this time be any different? Right now, signs point to yes and no, which is very unsatisfying, but also very likely to be true. Because this so-called Project Connected Home over IP Industry Working Group not only has a very catchy name, it's also one of the most interesting developments in the Connected Home over IP Industry Working Group. This working group is worth paying attention to because it has a better than average chance of succeeding. That's not often the case in the smart home space. In fact, it's usually not. For example, earlier this year, Amazon put together a similar industry group designed to ensure voice assistants could interoperate with each other so that voice assistants could coexist on the same speaker at the same time. Over 30 companies signed up. Google, Apple, and Samsung did not. And why would they? Right now, it seems like the whole game in the smart home is getting as many people as possible locked into your ecosystem as quickly and firmly as possible. Generally speaking, if you see a company asking everybody to work together, that company is either winning so hard it can afford to be magnanimous, Amazon and Alexa, or losing so badly it needs to make sure it isn't completely pushed out of the market by the dominant players, Microsoft and Cortana. But now we have all these companies actually agreeing to work with each other. The fact that it includes Amazon, Apple, and Google is a pretty significant statement. To get them together to talk at this level, which we never had success in doing before, is a great start. A great start, but certainly not a complete solution. Nor does it purport to be. The bare bones website that was rushed up for the working group says that right now the goal is to release a draft specification and a preliminary reference open source implementation in late 2020, which means that actual implementation of the standard in consumer products is surely even further out. Think 18 months for real consumer products in the most optimistic scenario.
Anybody who's watched gigantic companies try to work together to agree on standards for web browsers can attest to the fact that these things do take time. So what exactly is this working group planning to propose? What is the thing that they're actually making, and why does it matter? That, as with all things in the smart home, is complicated. The group wants to create a better low-level networking system for devices in the smart home. Right now, there's a confusing mix of different kinds of radios, Wi-Fi 802.15.4, Bluetooth, Bluetooth Low Energy, Z-Wave, and the list goes on. And each tends to handle its networking in a different way. The internet and nearly all other networks you use, by comparison, are IP-based. Each device has its own address and communicates via common, agreed-upon methods. So, at its base, this is an agreement in principle that the smart home needs the same basic level of common plumbing. In many ways, it sounds quite a lot like the Thread and the Weave systems that Google has completely failed to get any traction for, and in fact, Google says explicitly that it will be contributing those standards to the project. An IP system is promising because everybody basically knows how it works, and there's also just more knowledge about how to keep that kind of system secure. It also has the benefit of being agnostic to the kind of wireless radio it communicates over. It could be traditional Wi-Fi, or 802.15.4, or Bluetooth, or something else in the future. The good thing about standards is that there's so many to choose from, and that this is a proposed standard really is the poster child for that idea. It's noted that other smart home technologies like Z-Wave or even Amazon's proposed Sidewalk system won't be obviated by this, in part because they support longer ranges. These companies recognize that it's still too difficult to know if a device will work with your setup. In theory, this new proposal could help with that. If you've tracked the various competing technologies that gadgets have used to communicate over the years, you know they've always been a mess. Developers, however, are forced to make sure their product supports three or more different smart home software ecosystems. That's a lot of work. and it inevitably means some will get left behind, or busted, or worst of all, hacked. To be clear, even in a perfect scenario, this new system won't mean a beautiful, interoperable world. The very layers of software abstraction that help simplify the smart home are going to continue to exist and compete with each other. It just seems like Apple, Amazon, and Google would rather compete head-to-head rather than try to dragoon third-party smart home devices makers to their various sides in some kind of risk attrition. Plus, not for nothing, an agreed-upon solution for this level of smart home plumbing would mean that these companies could use the resources they have dedicated to that towards building other stuff. Well, one thing's for sure. Are there too many standards? Well, can one more make it worse or better? Who knows? Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Value Propositions in Employee Monitoring.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now is where we get down to business. We start talking about, all of the different things that happen in the business world. Oh, this is where I give you my experience of being an IT professional for nearly three decades now. One of the experiences that I've talked about recently was, I'm going to give you just kind of a quick overview. I was working for a company. I was working for Mr. S. He was the owner of the company, and we were dealing with two employees, M and J, and there were a few others there was that were goofing off on the internet, and they were doing things that were counterproductive to the company's productivity. And yet, I will tell you that there was no action taken against most of the employees along the way. And what little was taken was so minimal, so worthless, that it became evident to me that this was a situation where somebody was, Mr. S, was trying to utilize power to scare people, to, well, really micromanage employees, even though he was doing a poor job of managing. And no offense to him, he had me chasing down people who were surfing the internet during work hours. He said, okay, you know, if they're spending, 10, 15 minutes, doing a few extra minutes beyond normal amounts on Facebook or whatever, they take a matter of a 20-minute break instead of a 15-minute break. I don't care about that. What I care about are the egregious violations of company time. But you know what? He did this, and he had me chasing these down. And one of the employees spent a large amount of time, to the tune of hours a day, that were non-productive. Did he do anything about it? No. He stopped by and he scared them a little bit, but not a whole lot, because they didn't stop doing anything. I would say that some of these employees were addicted to the internet. Some of these different people, we've seen this in many situations. It's the internet is an addictive area. We get addicted not to necessarily something that is a physical substance. There are many people who are addicted to physical substances, but we get addicted to some of the dopamine rewards that come along with finding out new information. Wow. I will tell you, I am a knowledge junkie. I love finding out new information, and I can get lost in learning very easily. And there is a certain dopamine response that happens in my brain when I learn something new. Other people get their dopamine responses by doing things like shopping. You find a good deal and you get excited, and that dopamine response kicks in. Okay, so addiction, this is something that happens in a number of different ways, in a number of different avenues and tools and the whole bit. But the key issue here is we need, as employers, as IT professionals, as employees, we need to kind of figure out, where do we fit in? Again, I go back to Mr. S being much of a micromanager. All right. I will tell you that monitoring employee activity is not where we want to be as any kind of employer-employee relationships. You look for, yes, key issues. You look for them and you address them. You address problems. If you're optimizing processes, if you're boosting productivity, if you're protecting yourself against that employee who might be stealing information or sharing information, and, you know, there's some employers that say, you know, if we find out you're surfing for a job on company time, we will give you more time to look for a new job by firing you. I've heard that once before, and I was aghast at the approach to that, because that kills employee morale very quickly. You know, they're easier to, it's easier for them to go on out and go, look, I looked for another job and I found out that I was actually being treated really well. I found out I was getting pretty good money, not the greatest, but it's a lot easier of a place to work for. Instead, if you tell them, hey, we found that you were on monster.com and you fire them, well, that's going to reduce morale for that one person, but it's also going to reduce morale all the way across the board. So you don't want to do that. That's micromanaging. In a number of the different approaches that I've heard for monitoring employees, the ends don't justify the means. And even still, some of the different levels of trust that occur really, or the breakdowns of trust, I should say, really do harm to the company. I will tell you that, yes, if somebody asked me, do you monitor employees? To what level can you monitor employees? Yeah, I can. Yes, I do monitor employees at directive. Do you monitor me? I can't tell you. Well, can you tell where people are going on the internet? Oh, yes. Can you tell how to what level? Well, yeah, employee monitoring. Not to scare you, but we can tell by the link, the URL. We can tell that not only are you on this particular website, but you're buying this particular product. You're searching for the best price on this product. You actually bought this product over here. Yeah. We can get down to some pretty distinct items just because of how the web is built. But should you worry? No. If you are worried, have a conversation with your employer and find out exactly what they do in regards to employee monitoring. It is way too easy to get caught up in the vacuous trappings of the holidays, from gifts to parties to whatever. I'm a computer guy, self-avowed nerd, a techie, whatever label I like to use, but I like to put away the tech and spend time helping others. This season, it may be a rough year for someone or many that you know, so take a moment to reflect on those who you can bless right now or even in the coming weeks. It's my prayer this season that you also are blessed very richly. Season's greetings, and may your new year be a happy one. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. All Hands on Tech by Marty Winston, a Christmas Night Retro Perspective.
For those who celebrate it, Merry Christmas. Best wishes to those who observe Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or Festivus. And just in case I missed somebody, season's greetings to all. This begins the final week of the year and of the decade. And if you've been paying any attention at all, a lot of things happened that are important, and a lot of them are pretty good indicators of what the next year and decade are readying for the future history books. So tonight, I want to offer a Christmas night retro perspective. I'm not going to cover absolutely everything that happened in tech. I'm sure it's been a full day, and you won't need any help from me to fall soundly asleep tonight. I do want to hit some of the tech items that I found most, intriguing, and see what questions they trigger. Like Tesla Motors. Tesla Motors stole a trick from the Batmobile, and now they can come to you from where you parked them. Of course, you know, are you driving a Tesla? A self-driving Tesla isn't something you see a lot of on the road or in the parking lots, So I have to wonder, what if it were? What if a lot of people were driving Teslas? What if three or four people with Teslas, you know, three or four people with a Tesla, each parked next to each other, and by coincidence, all at exactly the same microsecond, triggered a come and get me, fetch kind of command? Now, for that matter, if all four are in a fender bender, if those four cars just all back out into each other all at once, which driver gets cited? How does law enforcement write up the incident, and will the insurance carrier for each driver try to get the other three to pay? Self-driving cars as a technology are amusing, but as an ongoing element in real life, the place they're most likely to drive me is crazy. Let me point out something I've mentioned before about robots and their ability to get where they need to go without incident. We've had more than a decade of robot vacuum cleaners, and there still aren't any out there that know how to dodge doggy doo-doo. And when they run over it, it ruins both the robot and the floor. Another factor? Next year, in 2020, we will see at least three or four, and maybe as many as a dozen or so, robot lawnmowers. Forget the doo-doo. Will they see the dog? The baseball, the extension cord, the garden gloves, the tricycle? Let's go over to smartphones. This year, we've seen advances in smartphone quick charging and in QI, key. I pronounce it key. I hope that's right, wireless charging. But the better the protective case you put on your smartphone, the harder it is to get wireless charging to happen. Figure that one out, industry. Speaking of power issues, there's an advance that the makers of UPS systems, uninterruptible power supplies, backup power, the makers of those systems and of surge protection could have adopted but haven't. I'll tell you what it is, and I'll tell you why it is I think they haven't responded. The electronic component that does the actual surge protection for just about every consumer electronic product that claims to offer surge protection is called an MOV. I'll skip the part where I explain what that stands for. What most people don't understand about an MOV is that when it stops working, you can't tell. And that almost always happens in about 2 to 3 years once you plug it in. So a couple of years after you get your surge strip, a spike comes across and zap, something expensive fries. Now there's a new hybrid surge protector component called a GMOV. It piggybacks a gas discharge zap stopper on a standard MOV. It fits the same space on the circuit board during manufacturing, and it can survive for decades. But I challenge you to find even one surge strip or backup power system that uses a GMOV. And I believe one of the biggest reasons is that sales have really slowed down on consumer backup power products. Most of the smart stuff we use has built-in batteries, so adding one isn't important, not to those items. The places where backup power may still be needed, well, that's places like the cable modem and the Wi-Fi router. Those can get all the protection they need from a $30 to $50 power backup unit you can get off the shelf at places like Walmart. The bigger system we used to buy for our desk-side system units, the biggest, you know, large UPSs, the little towers, well, those are growing dust bunnies on warehouse shelves, and the brands aren't about to invest in a new round of manufacturing that pays attention to the surge protection shortcomings of the current models that they haven't bothered to tell you about anyway. At my house, I had electricians add a whole house surge protector at the breaker box. It's built to be good for, oh, I'd say 40 years or more. Speaking of the breaker box, I had that upgraded from 24 positions to 40. Divide and conquer has a lot of benefits. Won't go into it now. Are you signed up for Disney Plus or CBS All Access? And that's on top of what else? Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, HBO Go? Isn't premium content how we got talked into buying the premium channels on cable? Now there's a new eruption of new ways to spend another $10 or so a month just to watch those few other shows or movies that you can't otherwise get. That would be fine if there were just one or two places with everything. But we're on the way to 10 or 20. Something has to settle out from all of this, and I really wish the cable companies were smart enough to be the answer. This was the year, 2019 was the year that the Air Force finally stopped using 8-inch floppy disks. And most of you don't know what a floppy disk is. Well, as you might guess, it's memory, iron oxide on a plastic disk in a cardboard sleeve. Does anybody remember Radio Shack? How about their TRS-80 computers? Back in 1980, the 8-inch floppy was the main storage element of the TRS-80 Model 2 computer. Ancient history. But hey, we're talking the Air Force, and they're still flying B-52 bombers, which are about 30 years older than that TRS-80. I could say that they're modernizing now, and instead of the 8-inch floppy, they'll now be using Bernoulli boxes. But you have to be pretty old to remember those things, so just chalk up that whole announcement to turning the page on a particularly outdated piece of tech history. Your flash drive runs faster and holds more. 2019, it was also a year for 5G. Not so much 5G deployment as 5G promises, or not quite promises. For most people, 5G is mystery meat. You might expect it to be the fastest internet data connection you've ever seen, and it might soon be for a few people who upgrade to some very expensive phones to take advantage of the new super-fast 5G service and who are within the few metropolitan city blocks that the early deployment of that service will cover. Well, there's another 5G, too, that will reach people who have been denied cellular data services, let alone any kind of reliable internet connections. But it isn't running at mind-boggling over-the-top speeds. It's easy to explain. When it comes to industry standards, there's no such thing as 5G. It's been seized as a marketing term. I've twisted some arms, so I'm pretty confident that rural and exurban people who haven't had any decent internet connections available will see new devices and new T-Mobile service in the 600 megahertz band that will let them rejoin connected society. As for the rest of it, my best advice, don't be among the early adopters. It should all be a lot closer to normal by 2021. It has not been a good year for electricity, especially if you're in California. Out west, the utilities cut power to a lot of customers as devastating fires swept through. And at least one of those fires looks like it was caused by a power utility. Nuclear plants are turning into a take-the-money-and-run game, as people who pay their electric bills and had to pony up to build nuclear plants are needing to pay again as nuclear contractors declare bankruptcy. And the utilities talk the state utility commissions into adding those even more enormous costs of shutting them down to the bills. For some reason, it's not getting treated as a scandal, but I think it is one. That's what I believe. It's been an okay year for drones. Prices are coming down, abilities are going up, and people are finding productive ways to use them. I think we'll see drones getting smarter in the next year or so, able to run set routes while dodging more and more obstacles. Home automation products are no less stupid than they have been. Really, do you think there's a bad guy anywhere who doesn't know that the oversized plastic doorbell box is a camera? Has anybody asked why you want the lights in your house to cycle through a lot of colors? And I still don't trust cloud connections with the ability to let hackers know when you're not home. I'm seeing good news and bad news in LED lighting. The worst of the bad news is in the low-priced junk bulbs at retailers. Fooey on those. There's good news in LED lighting retrofits for cars, and those will get better. I know we'll see more lighting that gets installed as its own thing in a whole fixture, unless it's just twisted into old sockets. Progress has been slow, but steady. 2020 will be a little better than 2019, but this is one area where I think the decade will show major changes that aren't quite as visible in just the year. Big for the decade, whether or not you notice it during just the year. I don't want to talk about wearables. Where they're trying to take health-related measurements, I don't believe their readings are trustworthy, and I'm pretty sure that most of the people wearing them aren't trained doctors who know how to interpret what they see. Some wearables are less about health or fitness and more about just being extensions of your smartphone. Okay, but if you want to spend hundreds of dollars or more to put a device on your wrist that connects to your phone so it doesn't seem that you're always looking at your phone, then ask yourself,
How will you not seem like you're always looking at your watch? One of my recent tech adventures was in the kitchen. This house that we moved into, April earlier this year, was built in 1979, so the house is 40 years old. It came with a built-in microwave installed over the stove, a Kenmore as it happens, built in 2000. So the microwave was just about to turn 20 years old. I'm sure you've seen or can guess what happens to old microwave ovens. The plastic dries out, discolors, and cracks, and it starts exhibiting that kind of appliance leprosy where parts start falling off. I had a temporary fix thanks to the folks at SureTech, who sent me their T-Rex brand crystal clear repair tape. I was able to tape on the louvered plastic vent strip across the top of the oven in a way that would hardly show, and it held. Things still rattled a little, but it held. That is a very tenacious tape. It's the go-to if nothing else is ever going to work. No question, though, that microwave's days were numbered. I did have a really positive experience not long ago when Sharp sent their countertop superheated steam oven for review. That thing is amazing. You could put a piece of raw chicken in it that would come out fully cooked, browned on the top, and as moist as you might ever wish. Now, superheated steam is hundreds of degrees hotter than what comes out of your tea kettle, so we're not talking about water droplets. But cooking in a superheated steam-infused chamber discourages moisture already in the meat from evaporating. Since that worked so well, I figured, why not? And I threw what for a product reviewer is a Hail Mary pass and asked Sharp's PR agency to get me the Sharp over-the-range microwave for review. I didn't hear back, but a couple weeks later, I did get a 62-pound box delivered to my front door. Score! I decided to do the installation myself, and we're nowhere near the end of this part of the story. Most microwaves that install over a range have their bottom rear corner on a secure wall-mounted bracket and their tops fastened with bolts through the bottom of the cabinet above them. So I took out the top bolts and the Kenmore wouldn't move. A sticker inside that you can see when you open the door gave that oven's model number and a toll-free number to call for service. I called it. It was Sears. I asked them how I could release the Kenmore microwave so I could dismount it. They didn't know, but they were quick to offer to book a service call. Ho, ho, ka-ching, no. The best they could do was to give me the number for Kenmore service, which I called. They were closed. I sent an email to Kenmore. Never did get a reply. I hit the search engine to look up the model number in hopes of finding an installation manual online. Nope, nothing I could find. I did a deeper search and found some installer forum boards, and that's where I learned the secret. There's a hidden release wire. You know that louvered top piece? I had to cut it out. I had to slice the tape. I'd been so careful putting that tape on. It was invisible. It was secure. Undo that. It was going away anyway. And I put a piece of foam and cardboard on the stovetop in case anything just came tumbling down. I reached in, found and pulled the release wire. The front tilted down. I could lift the back off its rail. And the Kenmore officially reached retirement. But it left behind several elements I needed to overcome. The holes for mounting those top bolts through the cabinet did not line up where they needed to go on the Sharp. And Sharp wisely instructs adding blocks to fill the space between the top of the oven and the recessed bottom of the cabinet above it. I made measurements maybe 24 times and got the hole on the left perfect, in part because it was offset from the hole that the Kenmore used. But the hole on the right overlapped. I used grinders and a wallboard saw to get that original hole elongated at the perfect angle, fiddled the position of the spacer, and was able to get the Sharp into place. Was it worth it? Heck yeah. With almost identical external dimensions, the Sharp offers two shelf levels instead of one inside a 1.8 cubic foot space oven, and it has 1,100 watts instead of the Kenmore's less than 1,000. It has steam sensors. So without setting weights or cooking time or entering any of that data, there are one-button controls for reheating, for baking potato,
for frozen vegetables, frozen entrees, beverages, or, of course, popcorn. It can melt or soften butter or ice cream or chocolate or cheese. That's another button. It can use time or weight to control defrosting. It has a keep warm button that can keep food hot without overcooking it for up to 30 minutes in case, you know, the dinner's ready, but the diner isn't. There's an LED light inside, an LED light over the range, an exhaust fan with three speeds, not counting off. You can stop its turntable from turning. It's a really smart microwave, made all the more worth it by being so much better than the old Kenmore, the Kenmore that had brought on 2 days of grief just trying to get rid of it. Thanks, Sears. Thanks, Kenmore. But a for real thanks to Sharp. Next time, our show is on the first day of the new year, a leap year. It's a new decade, and it may be more than too much New Year's Eve partying that changes our perspectives when we try to capture a 2020 vision of the somewhat near future. You can miss it if you want to, but you won't. I'm Marty Winston, adding my own wishes for a fabulous Festivus, Hanukkah happiness, a Kwanzaa extravaganza, a can't-miss Christmas, and for anybody I missed, season's greetings. My thanks to Hank, Key, and the others here for keeping this old jalopy of a radio show running for all these years, and whatever may be in tomorrow's papers. Forget about it for tonight. Just be the each in each other.
Thank you, Marty. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. The Westchester PC Users Group has a meeting January the 2nd, 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is the Codebreakers. They'll meet at the Keller Williams New York Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, Friday, January 3rd, 2020, at 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Long Island Macintosh User Group will meet Thursday, January the 9th, 2020 at 7 p.m., Old Westbury Campus, New York Tech, and they'll meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Thursday, January the 9th, 2020 at 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building. Check at the front desk for the room number. Brookdale Computer Users Group, they meet Thursday, January 23rd, 2020 at 6:45 p.m. in the large meeting room of the Middletown Library at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Wrapping up the year 2019, we thank you, the listening audience. We thank PRN.FM for making it all possible. Michael Horowitz is our webmaster, and he works behind the scene. I ask Michael to say a few words.
Hello, my name is Michael Horowitz, and I do the show's website, PCRadioshow.org. I want to wish everyone a Happy New Year and suggest a visit to my latest website, which is defensivecomputing.info. It's not just about PCs. It's not just about desktop operating systems. It covers defense both for mobile operating systems and much more, websites, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Again, that is defensivecomputing.info, and it is not a commercial thing in any way. There are no ads, no tracking. All right, have everyone happy computing. Bye.
We thank all the listeners for your continued support over the past 36 plus years. The show has continued to evolve with the technological changes from the time we started the program back in August of 1983. The most important asset of the Personal Computer Show is you, the listening audience. We wish everyone a very Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and season's greeting. Joe, you have the final word.
Well, Hank, it's the end of another year, and I'd like to thank you for covering for me all those nights I couldn't come in and you broadcast alone. I want to wish all of our listeners a very, very Merry Christmas, a Happy Hanukkah, and a Kwanzaa to remember forever. I want to wish you next year a healthy, happy, and prosperous new year. And I hope to be able to join you, if not in January, then certainly a month or two later. Hank, I wish you the very best. Good night, my friend.